the more we can do to reduce the suffering and injustice in the world, the better we have left the world when we're gone. And refusing to support the cruelty and torment of non-human animals is one of the single most valuable, powerful, and impactful things any of us can do as individuals and we can do as a society.
Welcome, listeners. I'm glad you are here.
Welcome, everyone, to the Live Vegan Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Leahy, and this is a podcast featuring inspirational leaders in the animal rights community. We are joined by co-host and legionnaire of logic, Ben Lawa. What up, Ben?
Hey, how's my favorite Kevin?
He is doing another podcast episode with you, and that makes me very happy.
I'm trying to think how many other Kevins I know.
Just me?
So no, you're my favorite. My favorite Kevin.
Well, we'll have to see the other Kevins and see if that means anything.
Sorry, cousin Kevin.
All right. So today's episode is going to be exciting. We have Mark DeVries as a special guest. And I want to introduce the topic by saying this. If white people think that anyone who is not white deserves less moral consideration simply because they are not white, that's called racism. If men think women deserve less moral consideration simply because they are women, that's called sexism. If humans think anyone who is not human deserves less moral consideration simply because they are not human, that's called speciesism. In 2012, Mark DeVries released a movie written, directed, and produced by Mark DeVries. It was titled Speciesism, and it has an 8.3 rating on IMDb. That's the same rating as Return of the Jedi. It's
incredible. You compare everything to Star Wars.
For the record, you didn't beat
Mark,
Empire.
This isn't the first time he's compared a guest to Star Wars.
Listen, that's an incredible rating. It's really hard to get a good rating on IMDb, so you should be proud. Speciesism has been featured in Scientific American, calling it brilliant and compelling. The Huffington Post called it tremendously entertaining. CNN Headline News, Psychology Today, the Sydney Morning Herald, and many others. Mark also filmed the world's first aerial drone footage of factory farms, released as part of his factory farm drone project, which has been viewed by tens of millions worldwide and received global press coverage. Mark has given talks at Harvard Law School, Stanford Law School, Dartmouth College, Brown University, and many other venues worldwide. He is an attorney licensed to practice law in Washington, D.C., and a full-time staff member for the Animal Protection Group and my alma mater, Mercy for Animals. Mark, welcome to the show, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. It's great to speak with you both.
Okay, Mark, I want to start. So the beginning of the movie Speciesism, you start and you give off this impression that you're like, hey, I'm no idea what's going on with animals. I want to look into this. And so I need to know, were you vegan when you started this?
I was not. I actually.
Okay, so you really weren't. I wasn't sure. I was like, exactly. Did you just make that up?
Right. It's funny. People often. Not only do they often think that I just made that up, but sometimes they don't believe me when I say that I didn't. And indeed, when I started work on the film, not only was I not vegan, but I thought that was the wrong conclusion. I thought, as many people do when they haven't thought carefully about the issues, I thought that was extreme. Well, you know, obviously, I thought it would be extreme to cut out everything that comes from an animal from our diets and our food systems. And of course, the reason that I thought it was extreme is because even when I was becoming familiar with the issues, I was so steeped in the status quo, in the idea that this is just normal and the way things have always been. And it's just, for some reason, the way things should be, that we should exploit other species so that we can eat their flesh and their secretions and so forth. It's only over time, as I was speaking with the philosophers and scientists and so forth who I speak with in the film, as well as doing the investigations of factory farms that I do in the film, did I switch my perception of this entire issue from being one that matters only to the extent that we happen to feel compassion or kind feelings for non-human animals, to being a fundamental issue of ethics and justice, just like all of the other major serious issues that involve humans throughout the world, that we take seriously regardless of whether we happen to have feelings of sympathy at a particular moment. So it was really that notion that non-human animals should be taken seriously, that issue of myself having a bias, a prejudice, speciesism, that switched my thinking into realizing how serious this is and how strong the case is for changing our diets and our food system.
It's really cool because, I mean, we all have our story. We all have our transformation. Everybody's like, oh, no, why were you vegan? And some of us, it takes 10 minutes. We go through a great long story. Yours is on video. You made a movie. You made a movie about your transformation, even though it wasn't intentional in the beginning. You're like, here, just watch this.
Right, exactly. And it's funny. It is great that, many of us have there are people who often ask us questions that lead to complex and sometimes difficult conversations. Of course, those are always really valuable because that's the best time to educate people about the arguments for veganism and so on. But it's particularly to actually have an entire movie. Why are you vegan? Oh, it's funny you asked. I made a movie about that. It's definitely sort of a special situation now.
Yeah, it's amazing. So when you were asking the farmers to disprove the idea that animals are being treated poorly or unfairly on farms, that was genuine. Like, you were genuinely asking farmers for help to disprove this notion that animals deserve some kind of better treatment.
Well, at that point in the film, I had learned about factory farming. So I assumed it was the case, and of course, my assumption was correct, that those animals were in conditions as bad as what's shown in undercover investigations and industry documents that make clear what the cage sizes are and what their living conditions are in.
Was a little bit of a play for you to try to get them to let you come inside their farm.
More so that I was willing to give them the benefit of the doubt and give them the opportunity to prove me wrong. So I was approaching it thinking, look, I'm pretty sure I know now what's going on in there in the factory farms. I was not vegan yet when I was at that point going to the factory farms, but I was already opposed to factory farming. I just thought that we could, legislate it away or something. So I approach them with willing to say, look, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt, and I'm going to try to give you an opportunity to show that this isn't as bad as is said. And of course, not only were they unwilling to do that, but later on in the film, I do get in to a factory farm. One that is
connected to Whole Foods.
Connected to Whole Foods and promotes itself as being a free range. And in fact, the animals were in the barns by the thousands, were so tightly crammed together and in such unbelievable psychological misery that they were cannibalizing each other. These were turkeys, and obviously turkeys who are, say, living on a sanctuary would not cannibalize each other. I mean, it's an extreme, severe psychological distress and of course, physical pain as well in many circumstances. And indeed, this was practically the highest standard that you would find in the industrial food system.
Did you?
And I was actually let in.
Did you have anyone get so angry with you that they wouldn't consent to be on the film, or you just had to cut it out because the reaction was so angry that just by you asking these questions or implying that they were treating animals, you know, poorly?
Well, when I do interviews, because people...
And I, sorry, to be clear, I mean stuff that we didn't see in the film. Like, stuff that was cut out?
Right. No, I understand. Yeah, when I do interviews, I generally, you know, get their permission in advance, as filmmakers should do, because then you can ask tough questions and you don't have a situation where people can sort of choose afterwards whether or not they responded to tough questions well. So it's important to get people beforehand. There are times, though, when I did not attempt to get explicit permission, like when we walked up to those facilities. And I thought, even though there are dangers to them doing things like, let's say, suing me for trespass or something like that, it was worth putting that in the film and keeping it in the film, because it shows that they have something to hide. And I think that's extremely important to show. I've had situations when to show also that they know that they have something to hide. I mean, I actually spent some time speaking with them, even off the camera, asking if maybe I could give them the camera, although I say this in the film as well, and let them come and show the stuff for themselves, or if I could come back at some other date and so forth. I really made some efforts to be shown around at some points of those at those facilities. So showing that they have something to hide and that they know it is quite powerful. And moreover, when I do the drone filming now, where I fly over these factory farms and film the giant manure lagoons with millions of gallons of waste and the piles of dead animals dumped into pits, I have situations where when factory farmers see the drone, they have done things like coming over and trying to block us in with their cars and corner us and force us to, say, hand over the footage or try to break the drone. And that, too, is a strong indication that not only is there something terribly wrong, as we already know, in the factory farming industry, but even the industry itself and the people closely involved know not only just how bad it is, but know that if the public knows, they will know quite immediately just how bad the situation is. That's why they put so much effort into actively trying to hide what happens inside factory farms, to prevent investigations and to prevent people from flying drones overhead or from walking inside the facilities. And that's why those of us who are on the documentary and investigation side of activism and advocacy and education have to continue doing everything we can to open these factory farms up to public eyes.
Yeah, because if what you're doing is okay, then there's nothing to hide, right? Like nobody would care. I mean, we can turn on the TV and watch how they make it, and they'll tell us, you know, show us, you know, whatever food that's made, but they won't show us that. So if they got something to hide, then something's going on.
I was just going to say, I've never been confronted by a corn farmer for flying over their cornfield, for example.
No, exactly. Okay, so this wasn't an animal rights film when you started. You're not thinking I need to expose all this. I'm gonna save all the animals. So what were you doing? So you had no experience in film. I think it said in the film you were a psych major.
Yeah, I studied psychology, and the other people assisting me with the film were other college students studying psychology and philosophy. I literally had no one involved in filmmaking who was involved in making the film. And I just picked up the camera and I practiced with it and taught myself how to use it. And then I taught the few friends I brought along to help with things, how to use it, which is why sometimes it's used incorrectly, as you see in the film. And it was the goal of the film was initially to investigate the topic of factory farming. Before I understood veganism and before I really understood the intellectual case for fundamentally changing humankind's view of non-human animals, I realized that factory farming was something to investigate. I didn't know what my conclusion would be, and I certainly didn't think my conclusion was going to be about animal rights or veganism. But I started out realizing that factory farming was a thing to investigate, and then it just expanded and expanded from there. And I didn't think that it would completely change my view of the world and the direction of my life. And I'm glad I was able to bring this sort of revelation that I had in the film to people, to the public in the way that it has. I'm so glad to say that I hear from people all the time who say that the film dramatically impacted them, that it changed their view of the world as well, because they were sort of coming along on my adventure and having the epiphanies and revelations that I do in the film while they were watching and considering these ideas and arguments. And I think that's valuable for advocates to remember, that when you let people into your thought process, rather than sort of being confrontational in the sense of, say, like just when you're just talking with someone who asks why you're vegan, instead of just giving them the facts, let's say, and stating why, you know, animal agriculture is bad and so forth, by letting them into your thought process, by saying, oh, well, I learned about this thing called factory farming and I learned X, Y, Z. And the more I thought about it, the more it seemed like there really is something to the case that we shouldn't support this. And so that's why I don't support this. Letting people along with you and showing them your thinking openly seems to open people up quite a bit. And that's, I think, part of what has made the film work in that way.
Yeah, it's definitely very relatable. And there was an extremely, I thought, touching moment when you shared your father's story. I think, was he in a car accident, perhaps, when he was younger?
It was actually in his early 40s. So it was like, you know, somewhat in the middle of his life that he had a really serious spinal cord injury, and his doctor actually said that he, meaning the doctor, had never seen someone that severely injured who survived. He broke his back and his neck and his skull and so forth. And wow. As you see in the film, he's in constant pain every minute of every day, excruciating pain, so bad that he would, as he says in the film, be screaming if he wasn't accustomed, so to speak, though it doesn't make it any less painful. And thinking about that, as you see in the film, made me realize we cause animals on factory farms excruciating, endless, inescapable pain day in and day out. Chickens in particular, as I can talk about at that particular point in the film, I talk about chickens and other birds, being bred to grow so quickly that they're collapsing under their own weight. And
I had never thought about it in terms of they don't move because they're in so much pain. I always thought it was like some kind of genetic disformity, or maybe the way that they're being fed and they physically can't walk. But the way it was presented in the film is that they physically can't walk because they're in so much pain. And that just like cast a whole different light on the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there certainly are injuries and deformities that are quite rampant in the chicken industry, but they're also commonly in severe pain that makes it extremely difficult to walk and causes them to commonly give up and just sit on the ground, as is described in the film.
Oh man, that's really sad. But I wonder, how much did your father's story play into your curiosity and finding the answers, because obviously you are on a mission to investigate factory farms, and maybe something deep in your subconscious was saying there are other beings suffering similar in the way that my father is suffering. I'm sure that's had some impact on you, right?
I think what happened was I was thinking about how much the animals were suffering and the fact that they can't speak about it and describe it. If a chicken could speak in a human language, at least, and describe the extent of the pain that he or she is in, it would give people much more pause than they have now about supporting that suffering or paying someone to treat the chicken in a way that causes that suffering. So I was thinking about how much suffering the animals must be in. And I realized that my father is in constant excruciating suffering. And I said, well, maybe I should speak with him about what the experience is like of being in that type of suffering day in and day out. And by suffering, I mean physical pain in this case. And I thought also maybe this is a way to help give the animals in a voice in a way that hasn't quite been done before. Someone who has an experience similar in the sense of the physical pain that they have to what these animals experience. And I think people watching the film commonly reference that as the point that was the most powerful and eye-opening to them, because it gave a voice to that level of excruciating physical pain that there's no reason to think these animals experience any less intensely than we do.
The one thing in the film that really struck me that I think maybe a lot of people don't realize, but is also very important, is when you discuss front groups.
Yes.
So I'm going to ask you this, and then I'm actually going to ask you a quick follow up. But maybe you could just explain what front groups are. I mean, we see these, like, you know, the PETA kills animals. We see the anti-soy ones and things like that. And how can we recognize them? How can we see through the, you know, the facade?
Front groups, first of all, are organizations, often nonprofits, that the animal agriculture industry in this case and other industries in other cases fund. And then those organizations look like advocacy organizations, and they attack legitimate activists who are opposing whatever this industry is doing that's harmful. So one of the things they will do is try to stop people from donating and supporting organizations that are effective. And ironically, the ones they attack are often going to be the ones that are the most effective and that have the biggest impact and the largest support. So one of the things you should watch out for is when you see advertisements, spokespeople, op-eds, And advertisements include online and on various other traditional media that attack what an advocacy group is doing. For example, attacking them, especially in some way that seems visceral, like doing something that seems clearly contrary to what would make sense in their mission, like saying that because the organization is harming animals in some way, or saying that they're wasting funds, or that they are something else emotionally resonant, like hypocrites, or that they're whining, or other things that have a very strong emotional tone, but are actually sort of empty when you think about it. When you see attacks against activists like that, that is often a sign that it's not really some concerned group of citizens who care about consumers or something like that, but there's an industry that has something to hide and that has something that they don't want support for the exposure of. And often when you see those attacks, you should A, recognize that they're usually ad hominem attacks that are not really about the content of the issue, but about the organization in some way that's just designed to smear them. And you should also then go to the organization's website that they're attacking. And usually the website will have information about who's attacking them and why, and that set the story straight. Organizations like PETA and the Humane Society of the United States do that in terms of the attacks against them. So you should be cautious when you see those attacks against nonprofits. Realize that there's an interest that's probably trying to stop something from being exposed to the public, and look at what the organization's side of this claim is, or response is to the claim. And you'll often find that the claim is clearly unfounded from the start.
I think okay, I have a bunch of front group activists in my Facebook friends list.
Well, I'm convinced that they're taking a new approach to this. And this is what the follow-up I wanted to ask you is, I'm convinced that they're now YouTube personalities. So we see people that, you know, claim to be vegan, but are attacking every form of activism possible and every animal rights group. And they're basically trying to convince people to just be good, quiet little vegans.
That's very interesting. And I wouldn't put it past them to do that, of course. And I could see that being an effective and dangerous strategy. And
how does that work, do you think? Do you think that like the meat industry would actually give a YouTube personality a check and say, please do it this way?
I have no idea, because of course I'm not even sure
if it was true, hypothetically.
I could imagine many different ways, both indirectly and directly, that a front group might fund, say, perhaps a personality, an existing personality, or help create a new one, which might actually be the most likely event. But what this means is that if they're focusing on activists and trying to sow discord within the movement, it's important and would be very valuable for us to actively educate people about that possibility. I think quite quickly when people realize that that's something that could be going on, they can keep their eyes open for it and not be as affected by it. They can say, when they see someone in a strange way attacking, say, effective animal advocacy groups, or arguing that people should not do activism, we should be able to say, is this sincere, or are there interests behind this? And we might see the same thing with written comments, you know, like a sort of trolling on social media, similar things like that, where things can be infiltrated by people who are going to pretend to have one view in order to sow discord and change people's actions or dissuade them from activism. And discord in general is a valuable thing to take note of, that the industry, the factory farming industry, the industrial animal agriculture industry, has an interest in activists fighting each other. And the more time and energy we spend attacking activists, spend attacking other activists or criticizing other activists and so on, the more they're not doing advocacy and doing educational work, and the better it is for the industry. So despite the fact that we will often have disagreements, people have disagreements between people with different strategies and philosophies, we should do our best to be directing our attention forward at the animal agriculture industry and the abuse of animals in general, than succumbing to a divide and conquer strategy on behalf of the industry, or just doing it ourselves.
Well, that's a good transition into the big debate of welfare versus rights. And I'd like to get to that and get your opinion on that. But I wanted to go back to animal suffering for just a second, when we were talking about a chicken suffering versus your dad. People will... sometimes not be able to relate at all when it's just a chicken. You know, like that story that your dad told, we can relate. That's another human speaking, and we can see that he's speaking very honestly, and we could imagine ourselves in his shoes. But when we talk about a chicken, it's really hard to put ourselves in the chicken's situation, and then to believe that chicken is suffering to a degree that really matters. So how do you parse that out? And do you, and you kind of mentioned this or allude to this in the film, do you actually think that it's possible animals feel more pain than humans?
So you asked a few different important questions there. One is about how people empathize and can develop their empathy for non-human animals. Chickens and also fish are particularly difficult for many people to empathize with because they don't show their expressions on their faces in ways that humans can intuitively understand. That's why we can empathize particularly strongly with dogs and with close relatives like chimpanzees. One of the ways to increase empathy for animals like birds and fish is to help close the gap between us and them by helping develop empathy for animals who are easier to empathize with. That's why oftentimes materials and information about factory farming and about why one should change their diet initially show cows and pigs. And then you can say, oh, look, these cows and pigs suffer in these ways that you can empathize with very, very viscerally. And here these chickens suffer just as much in the same ways. Now, there's, of course, some danger to that in terms of having to make sure that you are not suggesting that people eat stop eating cows and pigs, but continue eating fish and chicken. But when you approach it the right way, they can be a good transition. The same thing with talking about, well, you wouldn't do it to your dog, so why would you do it to this bird or fish? So rather than looking at humans and then animals who we have a particularly difficult time empathizing with, we can open the door by introducing people and having them think about the suffering of other animals who they can empathize with more easily. That's why I talk about dogs at one point in the film, for example. But also, it's important for us to recognize the existence of a prejudice, that people think that individuals who are different from them in ways that are not connected to things that we actually consider to be morally relevant, such as the capacity to suffer, we think that if someone looks different, they are of less value, meaning people throughout history. That's the basis for example, racism. And it's this propensity is hardwired into our psyche as a result of it being evolutionarily beneficial to think about individuals who are our kin or are within our social group, and therefore are likely in our ancestral times to look more like us. And so by introducing people to the idea that our attitude of not taking non-human animals seriously is, it appears, a form of prejudice, similar to prejudices against groups of humans, like racism. And this prejudice has been termed speciesism. When people recognize that, they can start to say, well, maybe I don't have this empathy for these birds or these fish, but I should. And I should because the fundamental ethical principle that we apply among humans, that causing harm, that causing suffering, all else being equal, is a bad thing, this extends logically and immediately to non-human animals precisely because they are capable of suffering. Regardless of whether we can empathize with them at the outset as easily as we can with one another. That's why my documentary, Speciesism, being the name, focuses on that concept. And it takes some time, which is why it works as a long documentary, but doesn't work necessarily as well to just explain to someone who you're chatting with. But when you have the opportunity to, let's say, for example, show someone this documentary, Speciesism, or other materials about this idea, like the book Animal Liberation, it can have a long-lasting and deep impact that just, say, images or videos alone of the treatment of animals often can't have. I think that's why this is such a powerful idea and has been such an important part of galvanizing action on behalf of non-human animals. That's why Peter Singer's book, Animal Liberation, which first really helped pioneer the use of the word speciesism, is so important and has been so important to the movement. As for whether non-human animals can suffer more than humans can, biologists and ethologists and veterinarians, various people in those fields with whom I've spoken, both in this film and in other contexts, including in my new film, which I'm currently in production on, have argued that there is indeed quite a strong case for believing that many non-human animals in many contexts actually suffer emotionally more intensely than human beings. And that's a remarkably powerful thing to consider, because when we think about why we shouldn't cause someone suffering, it's because of that suffering, because of what they experience. And if these non-human animals, whether they be birds or mammals, animals we empathize with well or animals we have difficulty empathizing with, if they can suffer as intensely or more intensely than we can, it makes the moral case for taking seriously how we treat them and for changing how we as individuals and as a society treat them. It makes that moral case even stronger than it was before.
And is that just because they cannot rationalize the suffering or the pain as humans can? The argument that suggests they experience pain to a greater degree?
The argument for that conclusion in terms of their emotional suffering is that, at least in many contexts, their suffering is not filtered, as the ethologist Mark Beckoff put it, filtered by explaining away, say, why things are not really so bad or something like that. Now, there are circumstances in which a human can do the opposite and exaggerate the intensity of a negative experience. But for example, the argument is, because we happen to have, as one of our noteworthy characteristics as a species, a particularly high level of generalized cognition. And I like to think of that as just a characteristic that we happen to have evolved because it was beneficial to our ancestors, just like owls evolved extraordinary eyesight and hawks evolved the capacity to dive at extraordinary speeds. Different animals have different extreme characteristics that they've developed. And our species, Homo sapiens, happens to have developed its extreme generalized cognition. But anyway, because of that, we can often put suffering that we have in a particular at a particular moment in the context of our lives being more or less okay. You know, if there's something that you're upset about doing or something that has happened to you that makes you sad, or something where you feel lonely, other social emotions like that, you can, even not by doing it consciously, put that in the context of your broader life and all these other things going on. Non-human animals may often lack that particular capacity to think of their lives in such a timeline, and therefore might be much less likely to think about a suffering or a harm that they're experiencing in the present in the context of the rest of their life being okay. And therefore they might experience it more closely to as if it were just going to go on forever. And the pain, the suffering, the emotional intensity might be much stronger as a result of that.
Now, your movie, Speciesism, is obviously about a very, you know, it's about the horrific conditions that these non-human animals are in, just the whole concept of speciesism and dominating another species. But you also find a way to use humor. There's a dry wit throughout this movie, and I'm assuming that's intentional. Or maybe it was just randomly funny, some funny bits. I don't know. But what I just want to talk about using humor to make an ethical point. So to discuss something that's so horrific, but to do it in a kind of a light and funny way at times, and how we draw that line, like how we, you know, decide what's okay to joke about and what's not.
Well, the question of deciding what's okay to joke about and what's not is very difficult, sometimes an intuitive judgment that it's easy to get wrong, context dependent, culture dependent, and so on. But in general, the use of humor, even when you're talking about very serious things, can lighten the emotional load for people of learning about something. And that's arguably why humor is such an important part of human life. We think of it as sometimes as something sort of light. And, you know, comedies, for example, are often viewed as not serious films, say. But in fact, the reason that comedians often are so highly valued is because they're able to, through the use of humor, talk about things, fears and concerns and ideas that people have, but can't talk about in just straight on sort of context. So I think it lightens the mood of a discussion, even about something very serious, to retain a sense of humor. And especially in the case of this issue, the people who we're speaking with are not yet at the point where they're taking non-human animals seriously. So they're not looking at the treatment of non-human animals the way they would look at, say, human slavery, even though the argument against speciesism would lead us to the conclusion that these things are indeed comparably serious. So by not coming across as judgmental or sanctimonious, we are able to open people up more to listen to us. If in a sense, we're not taking ourselves seriously, not that we're not taking the issue seriously, but not taking ourselves so seriously can make people feel like they're not being judged, like they're not being brought down into this depressing mode of thinking or topic. And it can allow them to open their minds more and open their hearts more. And it makes a film, in this case, more enjoyable to watch and makes people more interested in watching it initially and continuing to watch it while they're watching it, because it's fun to watch. So as a general matter, the more we can, at a personal level, not be overbearing in our approach with others, to be sort of light in how we discuss things in certain contexts, can really help open people up. At the same time, there are times in the film, for example, in Speciesism, where it does become very serious, where it's not the time to make a joke, like when we're talking about the specific examples of the suffering that animals undergo on factory farms, or the comparisons between the treatment of non-human animals and things like human slavery. So there are times to use humor to open people up, to soften things, to let people start thinking about the topic. And then there are times to move into a more serious tone. And that's something that in a work like the film, I developed and attempted to do intuitively and then saw what people's feedback was. And the same thing can go with activism as an individual. When people are advocating to others, you're going to do things wrong. You're going to make mistakes. And then as long as you learn from your mistakes and say, ah, taking this approach at this circumstance opened this person up, taking this approach in that circumstance made someone angry or disinterested or something like that, uninterested, I should say, or something like that, that's how we can, like I did while making the film, learn from our experience and learn the approach that's the most effective and that works the best for us as individuals.
So how do we be funny?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, one thing is not taking yourself seriously in a certain way, in a certain sense. And that is, that's what I try to do with the film, you know, like,
and like you said, sometimes it's hard because we're talking about serious issues, but you can't take it so seriously to the point where people aren't taking what you're saying and accepting it. They're just kind of pushing it away because it's too serious, right? So you got to insert humor sometimes.
Yeah, one way to do it is you're not joking about the topic. Like, nowhere in the film do I make a joke about factory farming or about the suffering of animals, but I joke about what I'm doing, about, you know, myself and my crew members, my friend Alana, who could not open the fence at the animal sanctuary and so forth. These are things that are about our story, and that part can be fun and funny, and that doesn't take anything away from the seriousness of factory farming.
All right, so we have to figure out how to make fun of ourselves rather than the issues. Got it.
Right. Well, we got lots of material, Kevin. That should be good.
That's a good point. All right, so I wanted to talk about welfare and rights, for example, and also maybe the idea of equal rights versus equal consideration. How do you parse these things out? You are a lawyer. You work for Mercy for Animals. I know people have called them an animal welfare organization. I personally disagree with that assessment. But how do you parse these things out? Are they one and the same? Are they the same movement? Or is there just a gigantic divide in the animal protection movement that can never be forged together?
Well, first, I think one of the things I try to do perfectly is, personally, is bridge that divide and not have my work require one view or the other in its use or in its in my presentation of it. So, for example, even though I work with Mercy for Animals, the work specifically that I do is that I make short documentaries, which Mercy for Animals releases on their social media. And the value of that being, of course, that their social media has a huge, broad impact. And these are documentaries that introduce people to issues like the scale of factory farming, the environmental impacts associated with them, and so forth. And specifically, I use drones to fly over the factory farms and document their scale and document the dead piles of dead animals that you see around the huge open pits of manure and so forth. And by doing that, that's something that can be used by someone whose view or conclusion has is that they should only promote veganism, and it can be used just as well by someone who's trying to promote animal welfare improvements. So my role, as I see it, is to produce resources that people can use to educate others and inspire change, rather than requiring a view one way or the other about any particular issue within animal advocacy. Now, that said, in terms of equal treatment versus equal consideration, that was first discussed in Animal Liberation by Peter Singer. And it's the main thrust of that issue is that because non-human animals are different from humans, just like humans are different from one another, equality does not necessarily mean equal treatment. Because, for example, equality between a child, a human child, and a human adult, in terms of it being comparably bad to torture either one of them, or they're being equally important under the law, those things don't require that we give the child a right to vote. The child has different interests, and you can give equal or comparable consideration to the child's different interests while still taking the child's interests as seriously as you take the adult's interests. In the case of non-human animals, as Peter Singer discusses in Animal Liberation, and also as he discusses in my documentary, Speciesism, treating humans and non-human animals with equal or comparable consideration for their interests need not assume that their interests are the same or even similar. Pigs have an interest in being on pasture and being able to build nests and interact with other pigs. Human adults have an interest in, say, voting and in higher education sometimes. And these types of interests should be taken into account based upon their differences, both between individuals and between species.
All right. What's the point of being living an ethical life and teaching others how to live an ethical life and making movies and showing people, you know, that this is what ethics is really about? What's the point of doing that if no one cares?
I think people do care, and people care indeed quite a lot more than most of us realize. And I think we have more reason to be optimistic than pessimistic. And we often greatly, greatly underestimate these reasons to be optimistic. What we're working with is a species, human beings, who are, with the exception of psychopaths and sociopaths, naturally empathetic. We feel the pain of others, and we're motivated to act to reduce the pain of others or to not cause pain to others. But there are competing motivations. We care about convenience in our own lives. We care about our habits and maintaining our habits rather than breaking them and doing something different that's going to take emotional energy or cognitive energy to do. And we care about doing what everyone else is doing. That's a big one. And because of that, there's a conflict. Most people, overwhelmingly, people are against this causing suffering to animals and in favor of being ethical and compassionate toward other species. And at the same time, people have a habit that they have had ingrained in them since they were very, very young, since practically when they were born, to do things like eating animals. And we're working against that the same way that people work against people who are addicted to, say, cigarettes. We don't say, well, you should know that it's bad and therefore just quit right now. It's difficult to break a habit. In that case, it's physically addictive as well as psychologically. There are certainly arguments for at least some animal products being physically addictive, but at the very least, it's psychologically addictive because it's, for the reasons that I just said. So as a result of that, rather than thinking of people as not caring enough, we should think of them as caring and really strongly stuck in their habits and motivated by what everyone else does, with everyone else saying it's okay and so forth, to do things like eating animals. So with that in mind, we should be compassionate toward other people who haven't yet made a switch in their diets and in their lives. And as I mentioned earlier, we should let people into our thought process and introduce the issues by saying, well, in a non-judgmental way and in a non-confrontational way, well, I learned about this, that, and the other thing about factory farming. And the more I thought about it, the more it seemed like, well, it's against the values that I hold to buy products from from an industry that treats animals in this way and to pay someone to treat animals in this way. And so I decided I shouldn't buy this anymore. What do you think? And letting them into your thought process and asking them questions and opening it up as a dialogue where you're both together looking at the issue rather than arguing against each other. That's the way to, with compassion and empathy for the people you're speaking with, help open their minds.
Yeah, there was a point in the film where one of the activists is driving a car and he kind of goes off on a rant about humans, and it seemed like there was a touch of I'm really fed up with humanity, and maybe more than a touch. And I know it's easy sometimes for us to slip into that as activists because we see so much cruelty happening to animals. And we want to blame someone. And so we start to blame our own species. We start to blame humanity and humans. But like you said, I don't see it that way as you do. I'm optimistic. I think that a lot of people do care. And there's a statistic that J.C. Reese brought up when he was on the podcast that 46% of people already agree on a ban to ban all slaughterhouses. So it seems like there are a huge number of people out there that are against this but still continue to support it with their actions. And I wonder how you feel about, and you mentioned before, what the group does. It's a big one, you said. That's why people do what they do. They want to follow the group and do what everyone else does. That our message as activists, go vegan, which focuses on the individual, versus let's end animal agriculture, which focuses on systematic change. How do you feel about those messages?
Yeah, that's a very important point. We evolved to our in our evolutionary past, the way that problems were identified and solved was commonly that someone was doing something bad and that individual or group of people should be punished or cast out or corrected in some way. So we're wired to see problems as one specific wrong and then to find someone or some group of people to blame. It's hard for us to see things as a complex system that involves no specific agent that is in whole and or sometimes even in part the cause of the wrong. So we often look at all of this suffering that happens and the obvious cruelty and injustice to non-human animals, and people are more angry and look at what appears to be the ultimate cause, and that's people, all the people around us who are purchasing products from these factory farms. And realizing that as difficult as it is to shift our view on this, it is in fact the case that there is a system that developed over time where, for example, animals were brought indoors and fed grains in part because of grain subsidies. And then there was competition to intensify. And it partially had to do with things involving World War II and all kinds of complex things that developed slowly with no particular person at the helm into the factory farming industry that we have today. And then all of the people around us were brought up being literally spoon-fed from when they were very young the products of these factory farms. And surrounded by other people who say this is just okay. And as a result, if we can move away from emphasizing the perceived fault of individuals and think about what is going to be most effective in changing the industry and in moving away from humankind's use of non-human animals for food, that will be the most valuable thing that we can do. And it does involve a shift in our own thinking about the issue from one that emphasizes a sense of like moral blame focused on particular moral agents to one that looks at the factory farming industry and animal agriculture more broadly as a complex social and economic system that we should analyze carefully and figure out how to change. And people like JC have written excellent work, and I know of other work that is on the way about exactly that systematic and broad approach. And we should always be open-minded as well when we think about our own approaches to what we might be able to do differently, how we might be wrong in a way that we have been approaching things, and how we can do the most to impact change for animals, realizing that the animals, not our own ideology, not our own ego or pride, the animals who are suffering were our original reason to be concerned about this and remain the morally significant thing.
Well said. Okay, we're just about out of time. So where can people watch Speciesism if they want to check it out? And also, what are you up to now?
People can check out Speciesism at speciesismthemovie.com. So the word speciesism is species, like a species of animals, and then the letters ism, themovie.com. Then there are links to where you can watch it on Amazon streaming and Vimeo and various other platforms. And you can also, of course, follow us on social media and share. The current work that I'm doing, I'm really, really excited about. In addition to the continued investigative drone filming and short documentaries that I'm doing, I'm actually literally out filming in South America right now, and I'm talking to you from a hotel room here. I also am working on a very large feature-length documentary that I think will go even deeper into the fundamental issue of changing our view of non-human animals, and I believe and hope will reach even more people more widely and in terms of the breadth of the impact and more deeply in terms of its impact on individuals. I'll be working on it for several years still. And people can follow the project. I'm not providing updates about it yet. It's mostly under wraps, but when I am providing more information, you can receive it if you sign up to the email list at speciesismthemovie.com, which literally will be an email that I'll send you at some point in the next few years. And same thing with our social media, which you also see on the website. But in general, I'm extremely excited and optimistic about this future work, and I look forward to providing more information about it when I deem it possible.
Well, that was quite a tease. You got me excited about this new right. movie. It sounds fantastic. And then you told me it's going to be years.
Yeah, it will be a few years. I mean, maybe a few years out. But I'll be continuing to work on short documentaries in the meantime. But I think...
So we'll check those out to get our fix.
Yeah, exactly. You'll be able to...
So no name. There's no working title yet.
Oh, there is.
There is, but you don't want to share it.
That'll have to be shared a little bit later. And it probably will change anyway.
Okay. Do you feel like you have to beat the 8.3 rating on IMDb?
Wait, what's better, the original Star Wars rating, Kevin?
That's what I was going to say. It's better than Return of the Jedi in its rating, apparently, but it's not The Empire Strikes Back.
It did not beat Empire. No, it did not.
What did Empire get?
Empire,
That's the big...
Empire got 8.6.
Okay.
If I remember correctly. I'd have to look that up.
Pretty sure. Both of those are very high. I mean, most movies, I believe, like, probably don't get much above, like, 7 or something. I don't know.
No, it's an incredible rating. Like, I often look at ratings before I watch movies, and to see anything over, like, a 7, like you mentioned, is really rare. So to see anything over an 8 is really, really high. That's really good. And that was your first movie. Like, you must be thinking you're some kind of genius director. You're the chosen one, right?
Well, I think about that. Plus, I haven't made The Empire Strikes Back yet.
Okay. It's coming. Maybe that's your working title, but you don't want to tell us.
Yeah, right.
Speciesism Strikes Back.
Yeah, right.
All right. Well, Mark, thank you so much for your time and your work and your dedication and your voice for the animals. And of course, thank you for joining us tonight. I know you're really busy and we appreciate your time.
It's wonderful to speak with you both, and I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, Ben, we're back. We just interviewed Mark DeVries, director of Speciesism. What'd you think?
It's a great chat, actually. Other than the movie, I mean, I've never met Mark. I've never had a conversation with him. I've never really, you know, seen much, you know, interviews or anything about him. So I wasn't really sure what to expect. But that was a great chat. I mean, he's a really bright guy. He comes through in conversation. I think what I learned about this was, The coolest thing was that this is, like I said, when we were chatting, he filmed his transformation, which I think is really cool because we never do that because we never know when it's going to hit us, right? Like when we decide, oh, this, what, how the way I've been living is not an ethical lifestyle. I need to change. He got it all on film. And like I said, when I watched Speciesism, I thought that was just kind of made up, not maybe completely made up, but embellished for the movie. Like I thought it was, you know, it was an animal rights movie that he was disguising as this discovery, but it was really cool that he actually just showed us how he went vegan on video.
Yeah, unintentionally.
Yeah. It wasn't designed to be an animal rights film. It just happened to turn into one. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, you never know where your journey is going to take you. And if you just follow the curiosity and record it, it could end up being.
Yeah, there aren't many movies like that in anything.
Yeah, you're right. I guess like every movie like that, I kind of feel like Michael Moore has done that, but obviously it's staged, right? He's not being
genuine.
Michael
Moore is very, very staged.
Yeah, it's clearly staged.
He had his opinion before. When
exactly.
Michael Moore makes a movie, he's got an opinion and he makes a movie to prove it. This one just came about.
This was a genuine curiosity.
It's really cool, yeah.
Searching for the truth and it comes to this conclusion. It's really cool. I loved the movie. I loved watching it. It was great. And then his perspective as a lawyer and then interviewing a lot of people that have been on our show, by the way, right? We had Gary Francione and there were a lot of people that he spoke to in the movie that we're familiar with. And the idea of pain really got to me. That was the first time anyone had ever framed it that way. It's for me, I'd never heard anyone say that it's potentially more painful for the animals.
Yeah,
because
it makes
like
sense.
More visceral. But
yeah, no, it makes sense. But you're right. I've never thought of that either.
Never thought of that. That just
and
makes
I like your
so
point. You know,
worse.
they can't understand why they're feeling pain. They can't, or maybe they can, but a lot of the time, you know, there's probably a difficulty rationalizing why they're in pain.
Well, yeah, I guess I'm not sure if I want to go down this road, but I'm just thinking like if someone's hurting a child versus hurting an adult, why is it more wrong to hurt the child? Obviously because the child's vulnerable, but it's also because like they don't know what's going on, right? I think there's a lot of elements there that
there's
are
an innocence to it. Yeah.
Yeah, they're innocent, they're vulnerable, and they just have no idea. So it's like, it's so much worse. And I guess that's kind of the same for animals.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd never thought about it that way.
So, but yeah, it was a cool interview. I'm glad we were able to set up a time for him to come on because I'm sure he gets a lot of requests to do interviews because it's a pretty impactful movie. It's one that gets brought up a lot, in my circles and with people, they often bring it up, and you know, it's, you know, there's the Earthlings, the Cowspiracy, the speciesism. So it was cool that we got to chat with them.
Yeah, it was fun. All right, cool. So what's in the news? What happened this week?
I don't know. What's in the news?
Well, you are...
Did you hear of any good movements going on?
You are the co-founder of a very big movement now, and you just had your annual get-together, and how did it go?
It's not a get-together. It wasn't a potluck. It was a march on Parliament and a rally on Parliament Hill to demand that our government stop subsidizing animal agriculture. But it went great. Anybody that doesn't follow, you check out Nation Rising, the Facebook page, or nationrising.ca. But the Facebook page shares a lot more. But we actually had Kaya, an 11-year-old, that spoke about the future and the planet and our government basically funding a world that may not exist for her. And it's a really powerful speech.
Is that the main theme when you guys speak on Parliament Hill? Is it mostly about the environmental impacts?
No. It's a three-pronged approach. It's environment, it's health, it is you know, animals and animal suffering. But our government, you know, they put out a food guide that says try and eat more fruits and vegetables, yet they fund animal agriculture, which makes it really difficult for us to afford fruits and vegetables. Right. Yeah. They don't give subsidies to the foods that they're telling us to eat.
Well, they and do, just not the same amount. It's so skewed.
No. It's like less than 1% of the same amount. Like there's billions, like $6 to $8 billion a year to animal agriculture, and like maybe 15 million
to fruits and veggies.
Yeah, I think it might have changed a little this year. There was some talk about them investing in pea protein, which is great. But it's still like it pairs in comparison. And, you know, there are people in low-income neighborhoods who can't afford to eat as the food guide says. Instead, they got to go to McDonald's where they can get a burger for $1.50.
Yeah, that's just wrong.
They can, and it's making your own citizens sick.
Right, and hurting the planet.
And it's destroying the planet, right? So we went to – that's mostly what Kaya was about. But I would recommend – you know, maybe we should get her on the show. She's honestly – she speaks better than 99% of the adults I know. No, I'm serious. It's I don't know. Maybe we should have her on to talk about whatever. We'll just let her talk. I'll just let her talk. We just like, hey, go ahead, and she can give a speech for 45 minutes, and you'll be blown away.
So it was a good turnout, and I know this year it was your second year.
We had some media. So CTV, which is the for non-Canadian listeners, is like one of our two big networks.
So you got more media exposure this year?
CTV ran a little piece about it. We were on we did a press conference that was on CPAC, which is, for the American listeners, is like C-SPAN. So it's all the government stuff. They show Parliament and when they're arguing and fighting with each other.
Right. So like when Congress is in session, C-SPAN.
We were on that too. So that was cool. We gave did a little press conference, which none of us had done before. So that was neat. But it went well. And the reason I know it went well is because we're getting a lot more negative feedback. You know, we're getting a lot more. No, I mean, this is great because you're getting more. You know, you're making a difference when the trolls start coming out.
Well, I was going to say, when we were talking to Mark, it's a badge of honor when the front groups start to attack you, right?
Yeah, and that's this stuff. You can see that it's happening now. And now, maybe after the first year, they thought, oh, you know, that's cute. But now they realize that we're coming back and we're going to keep coming back. And we're only going to put more and more pressure on. So now you're seeing more of, you know, farmers and you know, different things, fake accounts and YouTube stuff. You know, YouTube, probably front groups that are putting out things against your movement, because that's when there's a counter movement, that's when you know you're doing something right, and that's when you know you're growing, because every successful movement ever has a counter movement to try and say no, the harm that we're causing is good and needs to be done.
Right. Let's continue with the unnecessary suffering.
Yeah, we need the status quo.
Right. Yeah, wow. All right, so it sounds like it was very successful. You guys had a good turnout and a lot of media coverage, and I assume it worked better this year because Parliament was actually in session this time.
Well, it was actually on a Saturday. We do it on a Saturday so we can get more people.
Oh, okay.
But we did meet with some politicians, some MPs up in Ottawa, but people are meeting with them in their home ridings too. Which is great because it's their constituents that are meeting with them. So that's there's still people that met, somebody that I know met with their MP today. So that's going to just keep going, and we're never going to, we're never going to stop until the subsidies are gone.
Yeah. That's the part that I think really probably makes more of a difference, where all these individuals are meeting with their MPs where they live and telling them, as from like a one-on-one conversation, this is what's important to me. I vote for you and I live in your district and I don't think animal agriculture should be getting my tax dollars.
Yeah, exactly. We do the rally on Parliament Hill. We do the march. We get loud. It fires people up. We raise awareness. We put out some videos. There's a video that'll come out in the next week or so about the day. And it's great because it gets shared around and people are like, oh, yeah, we need to do something about this. But where it actually matters is when they get political. We can't just show up and start yelling on a lawn every year. We need to go meet with MPs. We need to lobby. We need to change this in person. And we need to go everywhere that our MPs are. It's not just, every time they do a town hall or do a debate or something, be there and ask these questions about subsidies.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's amazing. Good for you guys. I'm glad.
And we're already planning for next year.
Yeah.
It's going to be bigger and better.
Great. Every year. Bigger and better. We got to get Nation Risings all over the world. So if anyone wants to do that, by the way, in their country and set it up, contact Ben.
Well, no, we are working on that. So, absolutely, if anybody wants to do it. We do have they did one in Winnipeg this year, which is the capital of Manitoba. So there's going to be a couple provincial ones. There's one state in the U.S. that wants to do a local state one. There isn't anything currently planned in Washington, but if there was somebody that wanted to do it in Washington, it'd be fantastic. Imagine getting 1,000 people marching on, the Capitol buildings.
Yeah, Washington, D.C., that'd be great.
Yeah, that'd be huge. So or anywhere, any actually I could say any large city, but just anywhere, because even municipally they do it. It doesn't have to be the capital city.
Yeah, it's a great idea. It's another approach that no one's really tried to take advantage of yet. So I'm glad that someone's doing it. That's great.
Yeah, so thanks for having me on to talk about that.
What episode was that? Way back in the 30s, I want to say.
When you interviewed me?
Yes, where I interviewed you and we talked about Nation Rising. Yeah, that was a long time ago. All right, so let's move on to an excuse. You have an excuse for me?
Okay, yeah, I got an excuse. So this could be just like a fill in the blank, but so-and-so celebrity went vegan and then they said they had to go back because they felt so awful.
Yeah, it's been happening a lot, right?
So I know there's a Natalie Portman one, and every once in a while you see someone. So in the punk rock community, Fat Mike was vegan, which is the lead singer of NoFX. He's big in the punk rock community, and then he decided that he couldn't be vegan anymore because of his blood type. Right? Like celebrities making these just completely bullshit.
What reasons. Is? Do you know? I think you do. What's the blood type again? That supposedly is not
O negative.
Allowed?
O negative, which is what I am.
Oh, it's O negative. I just found out what blood type I am, which is O positive. So I was.
Oh, maybe it's O. Maybe it was O.
Just O in general.
I know at least it was O because I remember like, well, I'm O negative and I'm I'm doing just fine.
Yeah. No, I think there's so much to be said for that because we obviously want to do what the group is doing. We're very much social creatures and we want to follow whatever leaders we aspire to be like, and some of our heroes, some of our role models might be vegan or not vegan, and we look up to them and want to be more like them. So there's definitely influence there. I won't deny that. And it could be sort of harmful to a movement if an individual of celebrity status says, I'm no longer vegan because I didn't think it worked for me. But it's just anecdotal. It's one story. It's one person. And there's probably a good reason why that person didn't feel right or get the same experience that the rest of us have been getting, which is, you know, for me personally, way more energy and way better athletically, and just general health is better. So I don't know, maybe they were eating not a properly balanced diet, or maybe they were just not creatively going into the plant-based diet such that they would continue to be entertained and stimulated with those kinds of foods.
Or maybe they were fine and it had absolutely nothing to do with food and they were just looking for an excuse to be like everybody else and
change
their lifestyle.
The social part, like they just wanted, maybe they have a bunch of friends who were not vegan and they wanted to go with the flow and be a meat eater with their friends again. Who knows?
But they needed a reason. They couldn't just do it because then they'd feel bad.
Right.
So they needed a reason. Oh, now I don't feel well.
Yeah, so I wouldn't take that too seriously. People try it and some people don't stick with it. But even if they tried it, I think it shows that they're willing to give it a go again. And as these alternatives come out, you know, they keep getting better and more realistic, like the Beyond Meats, we as a society were much more likely to accept those kinds of things. Because yeah, like somebody who went vegan for 6 months is way more likely to eat a really good veggie burger versus someone who's never been vegan ever in their whole life, you know, and will only eat traditional animal meat. So I still think it's a good thing.
Yeah, I think we need to stop getting so excited every time a new celebrity says, and they're not even going vegan, they're going plant-based, right? They're changing their diet. But we need to, I think there's got to be, you know, you've got to be vegan for, let's say, 3 years or 4 years or something before we can get excited about it. Like,
give
we need
a deadline.
To know, you know, it needs to be like Joaquin Phoenix or like, okay, or Moby, you know, they're not going back.
Right. What is he on, 30 years now?
Not just Kim Kardashian, who now says she's plant-based, which is cool, you know, I'm not saying she shouldn't be. It's cool. Great. But let's not get all excited. Let's not make her our spokesperson now. Because in 6 weeks from now, she's going to say, oh, I had a headache, so I had to eat a steak.
Yeah,
like we can't rely on these people, and we shouldn't need to. The message is clear. The ethics are clear. We don't need Kim Kardashian or Beyonce eating plant-based for us to make the point.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And
because they're just going to switch. They just might just go back because who knows? That's what I said. I think they have to pass a test before we can give them publicity for being vegan.
I also think there's something to be said about being a leader versus being a follower. You know, I have role models in some respects that I look up to and I admire out there in the world, but if they do something that I don't agree with, I'm not going to follow what they do just because I like, you know, them for other reasons.
Right.
I'm strong and confident in my own convictions, so I can lead my own path. I don't have to, you know, look to others or other celebrities for like some kind of blueprint of how I should live my life.
How, you know, to be ethical.
Yeah. Like it's, you know, think for yourself.
Yeah.
Be your own leader.
Critical thinking. It's a dying virtue. No, be positive. Sad. You always tell me to be positive.
Optimistic Ben. Come on, bring him out. Where is he?
I told you once, like, is logic dead? I asked you and you're like, you convinced me no, but okay.
No, I don't think so. I think we're getting smarter.
You're an optimist. I get it.
Yeah, there's definitely lots of counterexamples, but generally speaking, I think we're doing better. We're getting smarter for sure.
Are you sure? There's people that swear that you know, it's good to drink your own pee now.
Okay, I didn't know about that one.
Like, that's a thing. I'm not making that up, and they swear by it. So,
dude, we could do a whole episode on things like that, where
Darwinism,
flat Earth, and I don't know.
I was reading the other day about breatharians.
I've heard about that.
They get all their nutrients from the air and light
and the sun.
Oh, that's a thing, Kevin.
I don't understand.
And you're still optimistic. Okay.
I don't understand how that kind of philosophy doesn't kill itself out. You know what I mean? Like, this should
be. Yeah, yeah. There's nobody that's actually like been doing it for 30 years. They're like, oh, it worked for him.
Right. It shouldn't be around anymore. I would think we've evolved way past those kinds of thoughts. Like 1,000 years ago, somebody tried that and they started a whole group and they're not with us anymore.
So, we don't want to alienate any listeners, but everybody listening, please don't drink your own pee or decide to live off your nutrients from sunlight.
How did we get here? But yeah.
All right, that's enough.
I'm okay alienating those listeners.
We call it a day. Yeah. Yeah, them and Trump supporters, we've made it clear.
All right. Well, thank you guys for listening. Hope you enjoyed this episode. And Ben, as always.
Hey, live vegan.
Thank you for listening to the Live Vegan Podcast.